Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
A wise man once said, "A true history of the world is a history of great conversations in elegant rooms." Sounds like the rest is history. Those are the words of the dwarf from Game of Thrones, Tyrion Lannister, that great historian. And that's our subject this week, Game of Thrones. Tom Holland, are you a fan of the sex and sandals and swords hit?
I am, and I'm proud to say that I was an early adopter because I read the early books before the TV show started, and I've got to say that it was one of the great reading experiences of my life.
Wow, that's a big claim.
Yeah, I got the first book, devoured it pretty much in a day, queued up early to get into the bookshop the next day to get the second one. I thought they were really great, and I kind of quite enjoyed the TV series as well, but I thought that the book was brilliant.
So had you got all the way through before you started the TV series? Had you got to the as far as you could
yeah,
get?
Yeah, I got as far as I could.
Wow.
And the other link that I have with Game of Thrones is that I once got Ser Jorah Mormont, LBW.
Oh, Tom.
In Glen,
yeah.
I'm aware that for people who know nothing about cricket and haven't read Game of Thrones, that will mean absolutely nothing.
Of all our facts, that's the most obscure.
That's the best, isn't it? which I guess highlights the way in which this is an episode that we risk annoying two constituencies. And one of them, obviously, is people who know everything about Game of Thrones. Because, you know, it's a while since I've watched it. I'm not absolutely on top of every last detail. But also, of course, there may be people listening who've never read the books, who've never seen the TV show, maybe wondering why on a history podcast we're talking about a work of fiction. And I think that the reason for doing it is focused by a question from David Haskier, who asks, how do you feel about the likely fact that the TV series has shaped popular perception about the medieval period more than popular historical TV or books? I mean, I'd go further and say that nothing in the 21st century has done more to shape the way that a broader range of people now think about the past than Game of Thrones.
That's a bigger, more than Gladiator. I mean, Gladiator is
huge. Much more.
Wow. Yeah.
Because it was such a phenomenon. And although it's fantasy, the whole thing about it is that it's rooted in kind of various historical episodes, various historical periods, all mixed together. And I think it's a hugely influential on how people see the past.
It's in a continuum though, isn't it, Tom? I mean, Lord of the Rings, Walter Scott, Ivanhoe, sort of Victorian historical evocations of the Middle Ages. I mean, Game of Thrones, isn't it just the latest iteration of these ways of thinking about the medieval past?
Right. So I think that's another reason for looking at it is that it absolutely does stand in a continuum of ways that we over the past centuries have understood, I guess, particularly the medieval past. But Dominic, for the benefit of those who have never read or seen Game of Thrones,
here's your
starter for 10. It's like a kind of Radio 4 panel show.
Yeah.
Can you give the plot of Game of Thrones in, what, a minute, 2 minutes?
Well, I did the French Revolution in about 90 seconds. So Game of Thrones is a bit
more complex, isn't it?
So for people, this is basically for people who haven't seen it or read it, because everybody else will be appalled by my gross oversimplifications, as no doubt they always are. So basically, Game of Thrones, I think, is two things. One, it's a story set in the sort of vaguely Middle Ages-ish time in this continent called Westeros, which is near the top of the continent. There's a huge wall, which is basically Hadrian's Wall, and on the other side, there's these snowy wastes, and there have always been stories and rumors about some terrible menace that's going to come from, you know, through the snowy wastes across the wall. And these are the White Walkers. These are kind of zombies. And the show starts with the realization that basically the zombies are coming. And this is looming over the whole story. So that's one aspect of it. So, you know, there's this kind of apocalyptic confrontation coming. But then most of the narrative is actually about the fight for supremacy in what are called the Seven Kingdoms. So there's the Iron Throne, which is the sort of, you know, the throne, obviously. And there is a series of kind of Wars of the Roses style shenanigans and sort of soap opera machinations as these different families, who are clearly modeled on different families from medieval history, are fighting for control. And at the beginning, you're invited. I mean, the distinctive thing about Game of Thrones, because some people will be thinking, well, that doesn't sound very distinctive at all. But the distinctive thing about it, I suppose, is that at the very beginning, you're invited to empathize with one particular family from the north of the continent. And it's very clear that they are going to be your sort of eyes into this world. And then the tables are turned by the end of the first book or the first series. And you realize that actually a lot of them are going to start getting killed off. And you start to realize that this whole enterprise has a sensibility that you don't expect, that nothing can be taken for granted, and that characters that you have invested in are going to be killed off really horribly. And then it's sort of, there's just twist part upon twist. And yet all the time, you know, the zombies are coming, which gives it this sort of other dimension. And then, of course, there is one third dimension, which a lot of people loved, which is the fact that it has dragons. And dragons are these mythical creatures that are kind of the ultimate weapon that people don't believe exist anymore. And they're going to come back and change the dynamic of the entire show. And that's basically Game of Thrones.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And to fix on the dragons, so I've got a friend who refuses point blank to have any dealings with anything that has dragons.
Wow. Just not The Hobbit.
No.
Wagner's Ring.
All of it. Hates it. Dragons for him are the absolute marquee. He's not going to touch it. So you mentioned both zombies and dragons.
Chinese New Year. That has dragons.
No, but they're different, aren't they? I think he's talking about the medieval Western dragons.
Right, okay.
Zombies and dragons immediately mark it out as the kind of thing that is not straight historical fiction.
Yeah.
So perhaps we could, I mean, let's look at both of them. So there's a question from Ghost of Film Past. Where did the idea of dragons originate from? And one answer to that is obviously, it's very clear, isn't it? It's coming from medieval literature.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's in a way, it's showing the Middle Ages in which dragons are real is kind of true to a certain way in which medieval people did understand the world, because they did think that dragons kind of existed. So before the sack of Lindisfarne by the Vikings, fiery dragons are seen in the sky.
Are they not comets?
Well, they might. That's what we would say. But in the Chronicle, it says it's fiery dragons. And you get reports from Armenia in the early 11th century of dragons sweeping down and vomiting fire. And you get this incredible report. Where, I mean, one of my favorite passages in the whole of medieval literature, again, early 11th century, of a monk from Regensburg crossing the Hungarian plain. And he's describing the details of his trip. You know, I saw this castle, it's kind of interesting path. Oh, and then a dragon shadowed me. And he had a huge head and he had scales like metal plates. And then he flew off.
Where's this? Germany?
Hungary.
Hungary. Wow. Who knew?
So of course, I mean, we might say, obviously, he'd eaten something or drunk something or whatever.
He was on mushrooms. He had too much cheese.
Yes, he had too much cheese. But in a way, one thing that is kind of, I think, great about Game of Thrones is that it does import the supernatural and the sensational in a way that is true to the way that medieval people perhaps did see the world.
Well, I suppose if you're a Western medieval person, a hippopotamus, a rhinoceros, you know, a Komodo dragon, they're just as fantastic. Yeah, as a dragon. I mean, why shouldn't a dragon fly? I mean, dinosaurs, you know, birds.
But there is another way in which, obviously, dragons, the role that they play in this series is incredibly modern, because they are a kind of super weapon. They are the equivalent of a fleet of bombers.
Or the ring in The Lord of the Rings is a super weapon, isn't it? And that the prospect of using the ring hangs over The Lord of the Rings. I mean, this is slightly different, but isn't it the same thing that dragons, there's a fear in the show and in the books that the possession of dragons will corrupt you. It's a symbol of ultimate power and the power of life and death over thousands, if not millions of people. Well, that's a tiny bit like Tolkien's ring, but it's also the way that it's very modern, because it's the way that we now think of weapons of mass destruction. You know, the nuclear weapons in World War II, for example.
But also it's very true to a very, you know, the circumstances of the 90s and early years of the 21st century, when highly powerful people did use aerial power to inflict devastation on enemy cities.
Well, I mean, I have a whole ton of theories about Game of Thrones being written in the 1990s. I mean, to me, maybe we should get into this now. Yeah. Before we get to the zombies, since we're talking about the 90s. So George R. R. Martin starts writing these books in sort of the early to mid 1990s. And I've always thought, maybe people think this is mad because I haven't really seen anyone argue this, but I always think he starts writing these books at the point at which, you know, the Berlin Wall has come down, the Cold War is over, the end of history has been proclaimed, and then history kind of restarts. And you have these hideous civil wars in places like Yugoslavia or in the genocide in Rwanda. And you have this sense played out in the headlines for day after day that sort of top people, as it were, the elite, are taking decisions that have the most horrific consequences on the ground in ordinary people's villages as kind of neighbor turns on neighbor and sort of, you know, the sort of the small folk, as I think George R. R. Martin calls them, they pay the price for the feuds of the great and the good. So Bosnia is an example of that. And reading what happens in his story, and this is where it differs from Tolkien. The war starts, so the war for the Seven Kingdoms. And instead of you seeing it purely through the eyes of the nobles, you start to see the consequences for these people in these villages. And I thought at the time...
And that's particularly true of the novels, isn't it? Much more in the novels,
exactly. People go, you know, the characters travel through these sort of burned out, shattered villages that feel like something from the 30 Years' War, or indeed the Second World War. You know, people have fled. They put their possessions on carts. There's a lot of rape. There's tons of sexual violence, which feels very 1990s, early 21st century. Yeah. You know, something that people wouldn't have written about 50 years earlier. Right. And it's at precisely the point when people are writing about the Red Army's rapes when they invaded Germany in 1945 or something. So it feels very of the moment. And I think that roots Game of Thrones very clearly in the sort of late 20th, early 20th. Yeah. It couldn't have been written at any previous point.
And I think that's true of all great recalibrations, fictional recalibrations of history. So it's true of Tolkien that Lord of the Rings is hugely informed by the two world wars. Scott is hugely informed by the climate in which he's writing. And obviously Game of Thrones is as much about the 21st century as it is about whatever period it's set in. And so moving on to the zombies, the dead who lurk beyond the wall, we've got a question from... yes, Angus Colwell, who says, George R. R. Martin said the White Walkers, who are the zombies, were a climate change analogy.
Yeah, the sense of doom.
Well, the recurring refrain is winter is coming. But in a sense, it's kind of, you know, heat is coming. Scorching summer is coming.
Doesn't quite have the same connotation.
No, it does. Here comes the sun. So in that sense, they're a very contemporary allegory. But at the same time, the idea of the dead rising from their grave is something that did haunt certainly the early medieval imagination, the kind of Norse legends of the Draugr who rise from the dead. I mean, in a sense, Beowulf is kind of, you know, the monster.
Tom, I think you can go back even further. Am I not right in saying that the epic of Gilgamesh, Ishtar, threatens to raise the dead from their graves or some such?
Yeah. And it's in the Odyssey as well. But I think this is specifically rooted in kind of Norse, Scandinavian, Anglo-Saxon traditions.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's interesting about Game of Thrones is that it uses authentic historical material and gives it a very contemporary spin. And that's obviously why it's been as successful as it has, I think.
Well, that's a huge element. And that's probably what a lot of fans will be expecting from our podcast, actually, that people have gone through the series kind of almost blow by blow. Blow by blow, I mean, you can interpret that however you like, I mean, it's Game of Thrones. You go through Game of Thrones blow by blow and said, okay, he is Edward the First, he's Edward the Fourth, this fellow is, you know, this Cersei Lannister is Margaret of Anjou. Or, you know, you can do that, can't you? I mean, people have done it. Or they've gone through all the places. So the geography is quite interesting because the geography is clearly different. You know, a lot of it is the British Isles, but set at different points in history. Do you buy that? So it's sort of almost different time zones.
Yeah, well, Dominic, on that point, there's a question from David Spracking. Game of Thrones follows familiar paths in representing the North as rough but honest, the South as sophisticated but decadent, East as barbaric and cruel, West as wild and strange. Are these associations with points of the compass constants in British European history? I mean, there is a kind of continental framing of it, so that there are echoes of medieval Europe. But I do think that one of the things that's interesting is the way that British history is absolutely central in this. And the reason that I think that's interesting is that Martin said that his inspiration was a series of French novels set in the 13th, early 14th century, les rois maudits. But when he comes to write this, he fixes on specifically British history. And I guess you could say actually English history, because as you say, the kind of the prime motor of the plot is clearly based on the Wars of the Roses.
Yeah, well, Lancaster and York, Starks and Lannister, I mean, it's blatantly obvious, isn't it?
The great dramatic cycle that tells the story of the Wars of the Roses is Shakespeare's history plays. And I don't think that there is any other kind of national tradition that has a great writer who has interpreted history in quite so profound and influential a way. So we've talked about Tolkien, we've talked about Scott, but I think that ultimately the huge influence on this is Shakespeare. And the reason for that is that everyone who speaks English, whether you're in America, Britain, wherever, that is the influence. So when you think of the Middle Ages, you think of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, well, I think Shakespeare's obviously enormously popular in America. And so English medieval history has arrived, is understood in America often through the lens of Shakespeare. I also think you can't get away from Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien is the person who basically invents high fantasy, or at least popularizes it. And the idea that it has to be in the North, that it is that there are always kind of Anglo-Saxon and Norse traditions at play, which is true with this, right? So in the North, in this story, the world of the Starks and Winterfell, it's very kind of Anglo-Saxon mead hall, isn't it? I mean, Ned Stark, who is the sort of family patriarch that you're invited to invest in the first book, at least, he's very much the sort of idealized Anglo-Saxon lord. Don't you think he's sort of feasting his
men? I do. And I think, again, that this is kind of what makes the world of Westeros hard to pin down, but also kind of very, very interesting question from Julian Lennox. What is the exact period of history depicted in Game of Thrones?
Well, that's...
An easy answer, but I think it's a bit tricky. In the Reach, they seem to be in the Renaissance, but maybe it's earlier than that. In the North, are they Norman Saxons? Can we say 1300 or 1000? So I think that... So there's the continent of Westeros. The scent of King's Landing is kind of... It's
London?
Constantinople,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's a mix of places. But the people who live there are basically late 15th century Tudor.
Right, yeah.
Then you move northwards and you go through lands that seem to be basically 14th century.
Yeah, they're kind of high medieval, aren't they?
The plot lines coming from the Hundred Years' War. Then you go further north, so into Winterfell, the home of the Starks. There you are in an Anglo-Saxon world. And off the coast, you have islands that are clearly Viking. So they're the Ironborn, who are seafarers, clearly based on the Vikings. You go further north yet, and you come to this vast wall of ice that George R. R. Martin has said was based on Hadrian's Wall. So that's a Roman construction.
And then you've gone really back in time because you're in Scotland.
Well, you're in the Ice Age because you're in a land covered with ice. So,
yeah. Okay.
So I think that's kind of interesting.
But also, what's interesting to me, Tom, is if you look east. So Martin does absolutely capture something that you get in Tolkien and something that actually you get in so much Western writing about the world, you know, orientalizing writing, which is that the West is kind of plain speaking and honest, and the East is sophisticated and corrupt and incredibly cruel. Possibly inscrutable as well. So, you know, in the East, they have these great slaver cities. They're very rich. They're very sophisticated, but they're impossibly sadistic and exotic and all of that sort of stuff. And in a way, so the way we think about Westeros is yet to be decolonized because through a very Western lens,
I completely agree. And I think that again is part of the appeal of it for lots of people, is that you can't have the kind of dramas or novels that you got in the early 20th century, where you have white hunters or white heroes going to remote cities, King Solomon's mines, or Tintin going to lost Mayan cities or whatever, and invoking the knowledge of eclipses or whatever to liberate slaves from their barbaric owners, which in Game of Thrones you can. Because the figure you mentioned, Daenerys Targaryen, who is the mother of dragons, who comes from a long line of kings and queens who are able to raise dragons, and that's the source of their power. And she is kind of basically sold into marital slavery to a barbarous leader of kind of Scythians stroke Huns, quite stroke Mongols. Yeah. And she becomes their queen and then uses this army and her dragons to liberate kingdoms of slaves.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the Aztecs and the arrival of Cortez. Chains.
Yeah.
And the way in which traditionally over the course of, you know, following the conquest right the way through the 19th into the 20th century, the way that the conquest of the Aztec Empire tended to be portrayed was as a liberation of people from barbarous rulers and priests and kings who were engaging in bloody sacrifice. And that is politically no longer permissible, but it is a very dramatic story. It's a very dramatic way of presenting it.
Doesn't she crucify the slavers? Isn't
she does? Yes. And then she ends up incinerating the whole of Westeros with her dragons. So it's not a kind of purely laudatory presentation of her, but she is the very essence of a white savior. I mean, her hair could not be more blonde.
She is. She's somebody going on a comet relief trip to Kilimanjaro, isn't she?
Yes. With a dragon.
But it's gone horribly wrong.
Bomb fleet.
But she's an interesting character because she's a kind of, she's a pretender. Well, she's not, a pretender is probably not quite the right word because she does have a very good claim to the throne, but she's a Jacobite figure, isn't she?
Yeah, she's Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Yeah, she's the queen over the water. And what's so interesting, now I hope we're not going to ruin this for people. Well, we are going to ruin it. But I mean, if you haven't seen the TV series by now, you're probably not going to. And the books may turn out differently, who knows? Because he obviously hasn't finished. But, you know, there's this huge controversy because at the end of the books, at the end of the series, all these people who had invested in her were really disappointed because she turned evil and, you know, she captures the capital, King's Landing, and she turns her dragons on the people and they incinerate everybody. And then in the very final episode, she's this almost sort of totalitarian style ruler, the dragons behind her, massed ranks of slave soldiers kind of doing homage to her in this sort of Nuremberg rally kind of scene. And everybody was very shocked, all the viewers who loved her and had named their children after her and stuff.
Yes.
So, oh God, this just hasn't turned out as I expected. But I loved that. I actually thought that was very good and very true to life because it was, I mean, maybe you would think that from, you know, you say, oh, this is the essence of sort of Burkeanism, that she's destroyed all these traditions and it's, she's a sort of Robespierre figure. Again, nodding back to our French Revolution podcast, she's suffused with idealism, but it's turned her into this dreadful monster. And I thought that was actually pretty true to the logic of her character and of the show.
I think both of us are in a massive minority in admiring the way that it ended. I like the way that Line of Duty ended as well.
Oh, well, that is madness.
Well, Dominic, while we're on the subject of Daenerys Targaryen, there's a question from Paul Duncan. Who from history is the best comparison to Daenerys Targaryen? Did any pretenders get as massively sidetracked as she does?
You've obviously got an answer because you wouldn't have asked it if you...
No, we were talking about Daenerys Targaryen. I'm thinking on the hoof here. She gets married off to a barbarian king.
Yeah. Oh!
And there was a Roman empress, well, a daughter of an emperor, Theodosius
I know where
the
you're
first,
going with this, yeah.
The last Roman emperor to rule both the east and western halves of the Roman Empire. She was called Galla Placidia. And she basically got captured by the Visigoths after the sack of Rome in 410. And she ends up marrying the Visigothic king. So I think that's a kind of interesting parallel, maybe kind of floating
around.
Yeah,
I buy that.
But
Judith
Dominic,
Heron writes about her in her book, Ravenna.
That's right,
doesn't she?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Because she then, rather like Daenerys does, she leaves her husband and goes back to the Roman centres of power and becomes a kind of great matriarchal figure. But there is another figure. So we've talked about how dragons... Basically, you know, you can see that there are parallels there to Western air power. And
yeah.
Daenerys sees herself as, you know, rather anachronistically as a kind of great liberal liberator.
She's William Wilberforce.
Bringing freedom to oppressed masses in far off lands. So, but wrecking terrible havoc and destruction by doing so. So I would say, as well as Galla Placidia, perhaps there's an element in Daenerys Targaryen of Tony Blair.
Tony Blair. Oh, yeah. My word. I didn't see that coming. Yeah. Emilia Clarke, I don't see her as a dead ringer for Tony Blair. I don't think she could carry that off. You well, honestly
you see,
think Daenerys Targaryen
you
is like
you
Tony
saw
Blair.
You saw Tony's long hair recently?
Actually, that's true. He did have that.
Quite Targaryen look to him.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, kind of slightly ravaged.
So
Targaryen.
So how are you going to justify this? She's the third way.
Because Blair sent out lots of military missions around the world, Sierra Leone, yeah, to Bosnia,
Kosovo,
Kosovo, you know, helping out oppressed peoples everywhere.
Yeah. There's a statue of him, isn't there, in Kosovo, I think.
And then he tries to pull the same trick in Iraq, and it all goes horribly wrong, and everything gets devastated. So that's my case.
Wow.
The whole story of Daenerys Targaryen is a parable about...
If the history publishing doesn't work out, I think you should write a parallel biography of Daenerys Targaryen and Tony Blair. I think that's got... I'll tell you what I think is interesting about Game of Thrones, though, Tom, and I'm surprised you haven't brought this up. I think it's the sort of the sensibility of it. So the sensibility is so different from The Lord of the Rings. And I think that's basically what a lot of people have seen this as. It's a kind of, it's not quite an anti-Tolkien, but it's kind of
a... It is though, isn't it? It was kind of overtly. I mean, didn't...
Well, Philip Pullman is the anti-Tolkien, isn't he? I mean, he's the anti...
He's the anti-Narnia.
Yes, he is. You're right. You're right.
I think Martin is the anti-Tolkien because he famously says, what was Aragorn's tax policy? And, you know, he asks difficult questions about what happened to the baby orcs and...
Yeah.
You know,
who cares about Aragorn's tax policy? Does anyone read The Lord of the Rings and really ask themselves about income tax in Gondor?
Well, I mean, it does open an interesting point that perhaps we should come to after a break. But one of the things that fans of Game of Thrones often say is that it's much more accurate than Lord of the Rings. And it gives an accurate portrayal of what life was like, particularly in the Middle Ages. I could not disagree more. It is massively inaccurate as a portrayal of
the
Middle Ages. And I think
that
I've gone on record. I said I absolutely love it. I'm kind of completely hooked when I was reading the books. I think there's loads about it that does hold up fascinating mirrors to actual events. But I think that it is if you have any interest in medieval history, it's a slight problem. The Game of Thrones now has this huge influence on how lots of people see and interpret the Middle Ages.
Why? What's your big complaint? What's your biggest?
Should we come to that after the break?
Oh, is it going to be the C word?
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, charge your glasses. Those people who are playing the Tom Holland drinking game. I think he will be talking about Christianity after the break. I look forward to it. See you in a second.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom Holland is about to embark on a discussion of the sensibility of Game of Thrones. I think he will be talking about Christianity. You have been warned. Tom, off you go. You have 2 hours.
Well, I'm sure Christianity will come up, but I think that talking more specifically about the idea that Game of Thrones in any way gives an accurate portrayal of medieval life, a more accurate portrayal, say, than Lord of the Rings does. This is based on the idea that medieval life was unspeakably brutal and that everyone just went around pillaging and raping all the time.
Yeah. So nasty, brutish, and short. Hobbesian.
No one would deny that it was a violent world, but it was not remotely on the scale of violence as Game of Thrones suggests. And I think that on all kinds of levels, Game of Thrones is essentially giving an 18th century and Enlightenment idea of what the Middle Ages was about.
Okay, that's
so for the Enlightenment, you know, the very idea of a Middle Age between a supposed civilized age, you know, classical antiquity when all was light and people just sat talking about philosophy, and then 18th century when the philosophers arrive and again everything is returned to light and everything in between is brutish and violent and aggressive.
Yeah, Dark Ages.
And people just go around slaughtering each other nonstop, and it's all rape. This is not true. Medieval civilization. I mean, in many ways, medieval. So just on the level of warfare, actually, medieval warfare was far more codified. There were far more inhibitions about violence, and there were far more controls on the ability of state actors to wage war than there were either in the classical period or in the early modern period.
Well, because armies are smaller, right? I mean,
absolutely. Yes. So the scale of violence that you see in Game of Thrones, that's the kind of, you know, so the storming of cities, the destruction of entire populations, that's the kind of thing the Romans went in for. It's not what, by and large, people in the Middle Ages did. And when you get, the notorious example is 1099, when the First Crusaders seized Jerusalem and the streets supposedly run in blood. The reason that that's remembered and is kind of preserved is that it was exceptional. It was the exception that proved the rule. That scale of violence did not happen. And the vast kind of teeming armies that you get with increasingly over the course of the show, again, this is, you know, you need a kind of early modern state to provide that level of violence.
But isn't one of the things that people think is as modern, isn't it so interesting that people equate being accurate and being a sort of a properly modern portrait of the past with being very cynical, very bleak and drenched in sex and violence? Yes. So in other words, people say, oh, Tolkien's terribly unrealistic because people are nice to each other and some people are virtuous. And people applaud George R.R. Martin's portrait of human nature, which is unbelievably sort of downbeat.
Brutal.
Everybody is really horrible. Yeah. Anyone who is virtuous ends up dying, basically. Everybody stabs each other in the back. And it's an interesting reflection on our loss of trust in authority and our disenchantment with politics, that we think that is a true portrait of what medieval politics must have been like.
I mean, the thing is that there were all kinds of attempts to regulate the violence inherent within, you know, mailed men with horses who, by their nature, can dominate and brutalize. So, again, the 11th century, the period, you know, that we talked about in the episode on 1066, the period that sees the emergence of castles, sees the emergence of knights. This is also the age that sees what's called the Truce of God, where churchmen bring out relics from churches and monasteries and succeed in compelling armed warriors to essentially kind of swear oaths that they will not brutalize those around them. I mean, of course, these oaths were broken, but it was assumed that they would be obeyed and followed. And there was, you know, I've just been reading over the lockdown, I was reading Chaucer, and Chaucer, of course, is always associated with bawdy and people having sex and people sticking asses out of windows and kind of things like that. But on the knightly level, the tales that deal with the things that knights do, the whole point is that they're not going around raping. So in the knight's tale, the whole thing is that you have two brother knights who spend years both hankering after the same lady. They do not rush out and seize her.
Yeah.
And even when you do get a rape, so in the Wife of Bath's tale, that rape is punished. The whole dynamic of the plot revolves around his attempt to avoid being executed for committing rape. So essentially, what Game of Thrones does not get is the way in which there are controlling ideologies, frameworks of morality, ethics that govern how warriors behave, certainly ethics that govern sexual behavior, that are simply not reflected in the way that, that Game of Thrones shows it.
Well, we've had tons of questions about this, actually, because people know your predilections. So Jim Longhurst asked a question about who captured the human spirit best, and, you know, is Westeros sort of the grimness without the Buddhas, Christs and saints that made the real world livable? Carolina asked the question, what did Game of Thrones misunderstand about Christianity's impact on the medieval period? So, okay, so some people say of Game of Thrones, I mean, we're sort of creating straw men here, but I mean, they do exist. They say Game of Thrones is more realistic than Tolkien because it paints a medieval world in which there is a religion. There's seven gods, I think, the faith of the seven. And there's also this really interesting kind of reformation movement, or this sort of evangelical movement, by a guy who's called the High Sparrow, and who's played by Jonathan Pryce, and he's very pious and austere, and he's this sort of purging flame with his acolytes, and they
kind of Savonarola.
Yes. Well, we've got a question about that. Somebody said, is he, you know, David Morgan? They look like Savonarola and his army of boys and young men. Now, do you...
So Savonarola, the...
what is he, Florentine?
Who the Bonfire of Vanities, and he summons all the Florentines to chuck their fripperies into a great bonfire.
But he basically runs Florence, doesn't he, Savonarola? Yeah. In the same way that the High Sparrow is clearly based on him, runs King's Landing for a time and becomes the great sort of power. Now, the question, I suppose, Tom, is do you think this does elevate Game of Thrones above, you know, its predecessors in making it more realistic?
Well, again, I repeat, I think it's an 18th century view that religion exists solely as a kind of fraudulent trick played on people.
So, yes, because none of them actually, this is interesting, none of them in Game of Thrones, I think, really believe in their religion. So they talk about the faith of the seven and they pay lip service to it. But nobody ever has these sort of inner crises where they say, sugar, I really am going to go to hell. This is nobody seems to believe it other than fanatics.
And even the fanatics are, you know, the kind of implication is that it's all about power and control. I mean, it's a very modern perspective on it, a very modern take on it. And that is why I think Tolkien is truer to the Middle Ages, because Tolkien, of course, was a very great scholar of medieval literature. And
yeah.
He entirely understood that, and he was also a Catholic himself, so he believed it. And the paradox is exactly as you fixed on, that in Lord of the Rings, there are no gods, there are no priests, there is no religion, there are no temples, no equivalent of churches, and yet it's saturated in a kind of theological understanding of the world that absolutely derives from medieval literature. The way that medieval people would have understood the world as being divided between good and evil. Game of Thrones isn't. And so the seeming realism, I think, is not realistic at all. And particularly on the topic of sex, I mean, the sex, again, a bit like the violence, is more classical. So the...
orgies, people eating grapes.
Yeah, there's a real trend in dramas about the classical world now to show the kind of casual way in which... you know, in a Roman household, slaves, for instance, would have been treated. That essentially their various orifices are the equivalent of a urinal. That they are
nice.
They are there to be receptacles for the bodily fluids of the master. And,
yeah.
And that is something that you do you see it in HBO series Rome. It's there in the new series that's out about Augustus's wife Livia Domina, which is good. I recommend it. And it's absolutely in Game of Thrones as well. But this is a kind of far more classical take. Yeah, we've got a question from Demetrius Bogdantsalis. So hyped for the Game of Thrones episode. Hope it's not disappointing. I would like to hear your opinion on any Roman inspiration that Martin used in his work.
But the court is very Roman, isn't it? The King's Landing politics.
Yeah, it is. But I think it's also deeply rooted in I, Claudius, as so many of kind of the great dramas of 21st century American TV are. It's hugely, hugely influential. And there are elements of the Julio-Claudian court, absolutely. To the degree that the guy who plays Joffrey, who is essentially Caligula.
Jack Gleeson.
Okay, so he's, for those who haven't seen it, he's the most terrifying ruler, perhaps, of the lot. Kind of young, murderous.
He's a teenager, isn't he?
Sadistic.
Teenager. Typical teenager.
Channeling John Hurt in I, Claudius.
He's John Lennon. Go on.
He's not John Lennon. He's John Hurt.
In John Lennon with supreme power. Anyway,
but he looks eerily like a portrait bust of Caligula, and I've always wondered whether that was deliberate.
But also that sort of idea of power corrupting, you know, of supreme power being incarnated in one ruler, and them using it for sexual excess, for sadism. That's very kind of Suetonius, isn't it? Rather than medieval.
But I think it's kind of there in Enlightenment pornography. Right. Actually, it's the Marquis de Sade, really.
I
think that Game of Thrones is clearly there's all the kind of medieval stuff, and as we just discussed, maybe Roman stuff as well. There's the modern stuff, and then there's this kind of controlling 18th century sensibility that is mediating both of them.
Which sort of sees the medieval world as this sort of cesspit. Yes. Of violence. Yes. So it is a kind of pornographer's fantasy in that sense, do you think?
Yeah, to a degree. Because that's how pornographers in the 18th century certainly saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about this? We've got a few questions about an event that people always mention, which I think a lot of people see as the sort of emblematic moment of the entire series, which is this event called the Red Wedding.
Oh, so my wife Sadie asked about that.
Did she? Well, this
is your opinion on that. Was there a source for that?
So for those people, those remaining listeners who are not Game of Thrones fans, the Red Wedding is this moment where this sort of heroic young king is sort of Henry V or something, isn't he? Robb Stark, who is the sort of king in the north. He pitches up at this wedding, and you've been invited to believe, you've been led to believe that he's going to be one of the great victors of the whole series because he's such a heroic, such a virtuous and noble sort of figure. And basically the wedding all ends really horribly and the Starks all massacred at the wedding. And it's shocking because it's a sort of breach of the laws of hospitality and all that. And there is a precedent. So, of course, it's Scottish hospitality, isn't it, Tom? the precedent is an event called the Black Dinner. The Black Dinner, I think it's from the early 15th century. The Earl of Douglas pitches up at the King's Court, King James's Court, and he is served a black bull's head, a severed black bull's head, which is a kind of symbol, you're going to die. And then he and I think his son or something like that are taken out and horribly murdered. And it's kind of remembered as this. But I suppose the reason it's remembered is because it's so unusual, because this kind of carry-on doesn't, apart from the massacre of Glencoe, so the Scots do have form, but it doesn't, this sort of thing doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't. And also it's not a wedding. So a wedding in the Middle Ages is a sacrament. And to desecrate, you know, a sacramental event like a wedding is incredibly serious. So
but people did kill each other in church. I mean, Thomas Becket died in a church, didn't he?
Yeah, but
butchered by his own altar.
But again, the exception that proves the rule, the king is whipped through the streets of Canterbury. Thomas is enshrined as a saint. It's remembered as the most shocking thing imaginable. Again, this kind of violence it doesn't really happen. That's the point of it. But Dominic, what I would say also, just on why Game of Thrones is so addictive and why it's such fun, is that I think it does give you everything that a great historical drama does. It gives you the sense of being in a past period, governed by strange customs, governed by strange ways of doing things, family dynamics, all the kind of stuff that you get from a drama about the Wars of the Roses or the Julia Claudian court. But because it's fantasy, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Yes,
and that's why this has the... I mean, I remember reading it and being devastated. And there's the famous footage of people watching it on the TV adaptation and kind of pulling pillows over their heads and screaming.
Who films themselves watching a TV program on the off charts that they're going to be...
go viral.
Yeah.
You'd never get that watching, Shakespeare play about Richard III. You know the princes in the tower are going to get it because that's what happened.
Yeah. But doesn't the guy who perpetrates it, doesn't he suffer a very Shakespearean fate? Isn't he served his own children in a pie or something like that?
Is he? Which I can't remember.
I think he is, which is very Shakespearean. Let's do loads of questions because we should give the listeners the impression that we take them seriously and love them, which we do.
We
should do it by answering their questions rather than ignoring this colossal ream of paper that we've got in front of us. So
we've got another question here from Paul Duncan.
Go on.
Who is really hogging the stage
Well, he's going to be happy.
Yeah.
Even if no one else is.
Is there any historical comparison to the doom of Valyria?
So Valyria is this old ancient civilization that has been destroyed and kind of swallowed up by the waters or something, or the flames
something
or
like that. Yeah.
Something like that. So it's clearly Atlantis, isn't it? Or have you got some other something else. I suppose it's a, you know, civilizations do suffer apocalyptic fates. We did the Aztecs just a couple of weeks ago, didn't we?
Teotihuacan.
So that's the city that predates the Aztecs, right? That's the civilization that came before, and they didn't know.
Valyria is kind of Rome.
Right.
Game of Thrones. It's kind of an ancient empire that was great and then has fallen and its ruins are...
Because High Valyrian is a kind of Latin that they speak, isn't it? A grand, prestigious language or something.
And I think
like
maybe there's an element also of the famous Anglo-Saxon poem about looking at the ruins of Bath.
Right.
And imagining it as the work of giants and having no idea who could have built these astonishing structures.
Gibbon looking over the ruins of Rome.
Yeah, although he knew.
He knew better than anybody. Well, maybe he didn't know and he had to write the book and find out. William Jensen, he's written a question about toilets, which I think will appeal to you because you know a lot about people being killed on toilets. He says, is there something, he's talking about the historical versus the mythical style. He says, it's impossible to imagine Tolkien's characters, Saruman or Denethor, being killed on a toilet like Tywin Lannister. Martin is writing in a lower register, which we take as being more realistic. Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it, about registers? And because people were killed on toilets in the medieval. Don't you have some good stories about that?
Harold Bluetooth,
books?
Who gave his name to the technology.
To Bluetooth.
To Bluetooth. He was fighting his son, Svein Forkbeard. I think we've already mentioned this on the podcast, haven't we?
And yeah, it was 1066.
He got off his ship, had a crap. As he was having a crap, bloke shot him in the arse.
So actually, Martin is being true to medieval form there. But he's right, though, that it wouldn't happen in Tolkien. Tolkien is writing
there are two registers, aren't there? There's the hobbits. I mean, I agree that they don't get shot in the arse, but they kind of, you know, they have drink and smoke pipes and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's, and then you have the high stuff. And that's going back to Shakespeare. So Henry IV, part one and two, you've got the high blank verse of, you know, kings and nobles and so on. And then you've got, you know, all the prose of people in the taverns.
Whereas Martin is writing almost entirely in one register, I would say.
Yeah, he's writing prose right the way through.
So there's no sense of the kind of grandeur. And there's no sense even that the characters really aspire to that, I don't think, by and large. That they
Except for Daenerys Targaryen Blair.
I love that comparison. That's the one thing I shall take from this podcast, from this entire series, actually. Saruman Dingo says, was there a historical Iron Bank? I like the Iron Bank. So that's this sort of Renaissance-type institution which exists in Essos. I can't remember which city, which is the eastern continent. And they're bankrolling a lot of the war, aren't they?
So they're basically Italian banks, aren't they?
They're a sort of Italian bank. Yeah. Venetian or Florentine or Genoese.
There isn't really, though, because isn't the thing about the Iron Bank that it... it kind of, if you default on your debts, they will come and get you.
Yes.
So they're a kind of mafia bank.
Yes, I suppose so.
Whereas medieval kings had, you know, they would default and then the banks would go bust.
Yeah, I suppose that's, I suppose the Florentines didn't have sufficient, you know, if you did borrow money, they probably couldn't do, I don't know. Could they do much about it? Could they send mercenaries to go and get you or something?
Well, I suppose you could sponsor a rival king, couldn't you?
Yeah, well, they probably would, wouldn't they? I mean, sort of Henry Tudor and...
Yeah, did that happen with Henry VII? I think it did.
Well, Henry VII...
There was an element.
Clearly must have been bankrolled. I can't remember enough about it.
I think in Wars of the Roses, there was kind of elements of financiers taking punts on rival kings.
We clearly need to know more about history before, before doing these podcasts. What else? Michael Adam asked a question about the impact of Game of Thrones on Dubrovnik. That's something I know a lot about because I've been
to
Dubrovnik.
I've never been.
City walls are fantastic. Dubrovnik is a beautiful... Michael Foote, the former Labour leader, used to go on holiday to Dubrovnik every year, which seems a bit repetitive to me. But it's a very nice city, which has been utterly ruined by mass tourism. And actually, Game of Thrones has kind of destroyed the life of the city because it's become this gigantic Game of Thrones theme park. And it does look... If you want to find a medieval... You know, if you went to Dubrovnik out of season, it is probably as good a glimpse of a kind of medieval walled city as you'll ever see, but not in summer when it's full of Game of Thrones fans posing for pictures on Iron Thrones. What about Hadrian's Wall? Spike Searle asked a question about Hadrian's Wall. Didn't Martin get the point of Hadrian's Wall completely wrong? It was never meant as an impenetrable barrier. Perhaps a linear forward operating base and or a customs border. Tom, you must have very strong views about
Hadrian's Wall. We talked about that in our episode on walls.
Yes.
So we won't go into that. I mean, I think that the role that Hadrian's Wall plays in the imagination as a kind of outer limit of civilization that's the key. And that is something that, you know, it's there in Kipling's poetry.
Yeah.
Again, that is
lesser breeze without the law. That kind of
It's mediated. This is a conception that is mediated through earlier interpretations of history, recreations of history, literary reworkings of history. And I think that adds resonance to the portrayal of history in Game of Thrones.
But also, Martin does this not quite nice thing where he has they call the people beyond the wall the wildlings, don't they? And actually, in had Game of Thrones been written 100 years earlier, you would never see the wildlings as people. You would only ever see them as sort of frightening sort of figures. But in Game of Thrones, they are humanized, and you are one of the characters goes out north and sort of joins them, and you sort of end up. They call themselves the Free Folk. They're kind of almost like Cossacks or something.
I'm not sure about that because the parallel for Kipling and for Imperial writers was with the Northwest Frontier.
Yeah.
So they would imagine Roman soldiers in Northern Britain as being analogous to British soldiers on the frontier in British India. But of course they were, you know, they were fascinated by what lay beyond, by Afghanistan.
Well, the man who would be king.
Yeah. Well, yes, which is actually a very George R. R. Martin.
Yeah. Story. That's a great story. That would be a brilliant podcast actually on Kipling and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, we're just talking about future podcasts instead of doing our own one. Fordek has a question, which I like a lot. Game of Thrones is usually compared with the Wars of the Roses, but to me, it absolutely screams of the Wars of the Diadochi. I don't know how to pronounce that, actually, Tom. Diadochi. Diadochi. Now, that would make a series. I agree. So the Diadochi are Alexander's successors, the successors of Alexander the Great. And I actually have a fantasy. I don't know. Fordek must have a window into my mind. I have a secret fantasy that one day I'll be reincarnated as a showrunner for HBO. And this is the series I would make. Two series on Alexander the Great, and then I go through his successors and end with Cleopatra.
How many series would you have?
12, 10. Okay.
But no dragons.
No, but pyramids. You'd have a lot in Egypt. You'd have the Seleucid Empire. You'd have the Greco-Bactrian kingdom.
Yeah.
You'd have stuff going on in Thrace. You'd get in bring in the Romans. Come on, Tom.
Yeah.
You can be a, would you like to be a consultant?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks. For the Roman episodes.
Yeah. Great. Great. Great.
You're in the money.
Here's one from Chet Archbold.
Friend of the show.
It's not a podcast episode without a question from Chet. Game of Thrones seems to me like the Middle Ages by ways of Nietzsche. Were actual medieval nobles as brutal, nihilistic, and utterly fixated on power, generally speaking, as the fictional ones?
He agrees with me.
This is why Chet is great.
Make Chet bang on the money great with that again.
One. Yes, Chet, I agree with you. We've already done that one. Okay, I think
What about Warwick the Kingmaker? Warwick the Kingmaker was very brutal, nihilistic, and fixated on power.
He wasn't nihilistic.
Well, I mean, he basically wasn't nihilistic, but he was fixated on power and brutal. Yeah, I mean, he is a Game of Thrones character. Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick. I used to love him when I was a child. He was my favourite medieval character.
And, of course, Richard III, as portrayed by Shakespeare.
Ian McKellen or Laurence Olivier. Yeah.
But the whole point is that that's an exaggeration, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose so. What about, have we got
time for one more, do you think?
Well, here's a good question to end on. Yeah. Johnny Wilson. I don't think that's the same as Jonathan Wilson, our former guest. I don't see him as a man who's going to be sending in questions about Game of Thrones.
Jonathan Wilson, very, very stark character.
Well, he's very northern.
I think we can divide our guests up into Starks and Lannisters.
Who are Lannisters?
I'm not going to get into that.
Paul Lay, who we're having on later this week to talk about Cromwell. He's a Stark, isn't he?
I mean, from the southern reaches of. Listen, Dominic, we're spiraling off here.
We are. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Johnny Wilson, got any favourite thrones?
Do you have a favourite throne? You must have a favourite throne.
The Peacock Throne.
Iran, the Shah.
Yeah.
Very good. Why?
It's Peacock.
That's not a good reason, in my view. My favourite throne is the. I've sat on the Iron Throne in Dubrovnik. So that's probably my. I've got a favourite.
Your favourite throne is a made up throne.
Oh, it was plastic, actually.
And you're sneering at me for choosing an actual throne.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least I sat on
with
my throne.
Peacocks.
I've chosen a Disney type throne, which is, of course, what my listeners would expect as a man of the people.
I thought the Iron Throne was in Belfast.
I think the truth is there were probably multiple Iron Thrones, and I may well have paid good money. I may well have paid good money to a Croatian entrepreneur to sit on a fake Iron Throne, which I think is a nice epitaph for my entire life.
There was a photo of the Queen looking at...
On the Iron Throne?
No, looking at it.
All right. I think there should be... I can't believe she didn't sit in it. I mean, she should have done. Prince Philip would have been.
Would have been straight on it. Yeah, Prince Harry.
Well, Prince Harry is a very Game of Thrones character.
Yeah.
Isn't he? So I mean, I think he definitely ends up dead in Game of Thrones, doesn't he? He doesn't win, does he?
Yeah. What about William?
I think William might survive. I think William would come through. Yeah. No, I don't know.
He'd die at the end of season two.
Who would win?
Ooh,
Princess Beatrice or somebody?
Prince Edward. Prince Edward's my favourite member of the royal family.
Why?
Do you know why?
His acting or his theatrical career with Andrew Lloyd Webber?
No, I went to a service to commemorate the anniversary of the death of Æthelflæd, Lady of the Mercians, in Tamworth.
Right. That sounds exactly the kind of thing you would do.
Yeah, it was great. There was the local feared had arrived in chainmail. There was the Mercian regiment with the regimental sheep.
Regimental sheep. Wow.
I think there were 12 bishops. It was a fantastic occasion. And after it, we went to the castle in Tamworth. Prince Edward was there. And he said he was a big fan of Rubicon.
My God.
So up to that point, I'd had no time for the man. But now...
that is galling. Well, I
hope he becomes king.
I happen to know Prince Andrew is a very big fan of my book, State of Emergency, about the Ted Heath years.
You don't want Prince Andrew, though, do you? So I've become Prince Edward's banner man.
Yeah, wow.
And I am willing to do what it takes.
But you see, you've given the game away.
And get him onto the Iron Throne.
When the Super Bowl breaks out, I will know where you stand, and I can use that against you. Well, on that note...
You and Prince Andrew. I don't think that's anything to boast about.
No. I might have to ditch him. Right. On that note, I think we should bring the podcast to an end, as we've completely lost track of the questions, the subject, our audience... And, yeah, life itself. So, we will be back, won't we, with Paul Lay talking about...
Oliver Cromwell, the Protectorate, Britain's experiment with republicanism.
I think we'll keep that one more on track, probably, than we did. And then in the future, for people who like Game of Thrones, gods, all that sort of stuff, the World Cup of Ancient Gods is looming.
That's massive,
isn't
it?
We're going to be advertising
than the Euros.
I think it's much bigger than the Euros. Well, it hasn't been postponed. Unlike the Euros, so we can actually deliver it on time and on schedule, and everybody can go. Like, there's no restrictions on. It'll be on Twitter. All are welcome. Please vote if you have a favourite ancient god. Let's hope they've made it to the last 16. You know,
huge excitement.
There's a massive.
But for now,
yeah,
I think we've had enough. It's the end of Game of Thrones.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.